Hello, everybody. This is Billy Tucci from Apostle Arts, publishers of A Child is Born, and you are listening to Darkness to Light. Thank you, and God bless.
Darkness to Light, hosted by Emily and Alan Middleton.
We aim to explore what takes place at the corner of theology and geekology.
Episode 10, It's a Rebirth Holiday Miracle.
Welcome to episode 10 of Darkness to Light. This is our show where we take a look at pop culture in terms of where those stories intersect with concepts in religion, faith, theology, and spirituality.
And today we are taking a look at the DC Rebirth Holiday Special.
This is an unofficial sort of sequel to episode 48 of the Short Box Showcase. And I'm sure that most of our listeners here know us from our other podcasting ventures, to which this is our side project. But there are probably a few of you who came to this show just as this show. So we will briefly promote our main podcast feed, which is the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network.
Self-promotion is the definition of podcasting. So that feed includes your solo show, the Quarter Bin Podcast, and also your comics reading journal, as well as my late lamented show, Uncovering the Bronze Age.
Still the most popular show on the network.
I know. I'm sorry, guys. I'm very sorry. And finally, that feed also hosts the flagship show we do together, the Short Box Showcase.
And on the most recent episode of that, we gave our thoughts on all of the DC Comics Rebirth books that we've read over the last 6 months. And now to finish out the year, we have more DC Rebirth. And this was holiday themed, so we thought it's Darkness to Light themed.
Indeed it is. And then we read it and we're like, oh yeah, this is a...
Definitely
what we're going to go with. If you've listened to our previous holiday special, you know that I am always up on a soapbox about the lack of Hanukkah specials.
That's fixed.
That is fixed.
That is fixed here.
This is a true holiday special, and I really appreciated it.
So this DC Rebirth holiday special did have a cover price of $9.99.
Which, if you know what we were talking about with DC Rebirth, is shocking, since all their other books are $2.99. However, the special is 96 pages long with 10 brand new stories all set in this new version of the DC Universe.
Now, a couple of those are one-pagers, but still, technically speaking, it is 10 new stories. So we're just going to go through the table of contents just to let you know what characters and creators are in there, and then we'll talk a little bit more in depth, though not in a lot of depth.
Well, some of these stories are... Five pages. Panels. So.
Yes. we'll just hit the highlights of each one of the stories. Many brief reviews with technically, I guess, some spoilers potentially thrown in, though I don't even think they rise to that level.
It's a holiday anthology story. You can pretty much guess what's going to happen once we read the table of contents and decide if you're interested in picking this up. Side note, if you do not want to pay the $9.99, for the special, which I do think is absolutely worth it, this will also be released on Hoopla as part of the DC Rebirth Hoopla collaboration extravaganza.
Which starts, we think, in mid-January. So there is sort of a framing sequence that goes throughout these stories, and all of that has been titled A Very Harley Holiday. That was by Paul Dini and Elsa Carretier. And Harley is basically the hostess for the book, sort of fitting the role of both host of a variety TV show comic book, sort of fitting in for where, you know, Cain or Abel would introduce the House of Mystery or the Crypt Keeper, sort of fulfilling that storytelling function as well.
And within the context of the story, basically being the TV host of a PBS call-in holiday special type thing where, as she puts it, a bunch of celebrities get together, drink on air, and pretend they know each other. Of course, this story is written by Paul Dini and features Harley Quinn, and it is thus excellent.
Harley is by definition a problematic character, but that's only when she's with the Joker.
Yes.
Harley on her own can be sort of delightful, I think.
I would say very delightful. And this whole story is delightful, and all of the stories contained within it, same.
So what we have in here are Superman and Batman in The Last Minute by Tim Seeley and Ian Churchill.
Followed by Superboy and Crypto in For the Dog Who Has Everything, written by Eric Esquivel with art by Dan Jurgens and Norm Rapmond.
Batman and Detective Chimp. That's right. I don't even think I need to say the rest of the story or the details, because that's enough to attract you to read that story.
It is an oversized DC special.
It had to have a talking monkey in it. Well, that is The Night We Saved Christmas by Heath Corson and Gustavo Duarte.
Next, my favorite story.
Maybe your two favorite characters together for maybe the first time.
Wonder Woman and Constantine in Dreaming of a White Christmas, written by Mariko Tamaki and drawn by Matias Bergara.
The Flash in A Flash Christmas Carol, written by one of our favorites, James Tynion IV, with art by Robbie Rodriguez.
New Superman in Day of Returning, written by Gene Yang and drawn by Andrea Muti.
Batwoman in Light in the Dark by Kay Perkins and Paolo Pantolina.
The Titans in What a Year for a New Year by James Asmus, Riley Brown, and Scott Hanna.
Batgirl and Nightwing in I Don't Want to Be Late by Bill Freeberger and Thomas Petilli.
And finally, Green Lanterns in The Epiphany, written by Steve Orlando and Vita Ayala, drawn by V. Ken Marion and Mick Gray.
So we're going to run through it pretty quick. So we get Superman and Batman in The Last Minute. And the theme of that one is that it's pretty tough being a superhero and a dad. And even if you are able to move at super speed, like Superman is, sometimes you just can't be fast enough to get the last toy off the shelf.
This story is basically the Jingle All the Way premise of my kid just needs that toy so badly and it's all sold out, so I will go check every single store at super speed. But as we said, sometimes you just can't beat out a Wayne for the final toy of the season.
And no spoilers, but it does have a happy ending.
It does. In this story, we get to see not just Batman and Superman teaming up, but the Waynes, Bruce and Damian,
and
the Kents slash Smiths, if you're following the stuff that's going on with the Supers at this point.
And if you had to guess, which of these two families would have matching pajamas
with reindeers on them?
You're right.
Yeah.
It's Clark and Lois and John.
And Damian and Bruce, of course, wearing not matching, but could be matching suits. Damian does look exactly like Artemis Fowl. It's slightly disconcerting.
It is kind of creepy.
But, as we said, in the end, happy, warm, fuzzy feelings all around as everyone gets to spend the Christmas time together with each other, take a break from the superheroing, and just relax like normal people for a little while. Then we have a single page of the framing story in which Harley gets to save Christmas with the help of Crypto Rudolph. It's adorable.
And then, speaking of pets and dogs, we get For the Dog Who Has Everything. And I have to say, I was a little worried. We have joked again in podcasts on our main feed about the tendency of DC Comics to regularly return to the classic Alan Moore story for the man who has everything. This one simply is a swipe of the title.
Yes, and has a very cute, fun, lighthearted story of, quite literally, what do you get Crypto for Christmas?
And we can say it does involve
The Fortress of Solitude.
And a nice shout out to former fans of prior versions of Superman.
And it's generally adorable. We get a little bit of somewhat sadness of, mm-hmm. you know, we are the last of our culture, and it's important to remember that, and talking about the importance of connecting to your heritage. There's some stuff about, you know, you may feel alone, Crypto, but so does Dad, and so do I, and so does Mom, I think, but we can be alone together at Christmas. Mm-hmm. And that is the true meaning of family. It's adorable.
Do you know those friends who, instead of giving you a gift for Christmas, they'll make a donation in your name to a charity?
If you had to guess which member of the Justice League did this, again, you are correct.
It was Bruce. And he has not made his friends happy.
No. For a man with that much money, really, really terrible gift giver. And so smug.
The picture of him sipping daintily at his Christmas-themed...
his bowed teacup.
Says it all, I believe. Says it all. But then we get dark and we get gritty. I don't like the cold. See, I'm a chimp. The name's Bobo, but some folks call me Detective Chimp.
Aw, yes. Detective Chimp and Batman teaming up to save Christmas. Starts with I don't know if this is a trope by this point, but one of my favorite occurrences, which is Mall Santa gets jacked on Christmas, and thus you have to go help Santa. Detective Chimp takes a case where he's going to find this Mall Santa's pet dog.
Mm-hmm.
And with Batman's help, he does.
Now, what I like about this is that Detective Chimp clearly has a long-standing relationship with Batman, or at least with his butler, Alfie. They seem to know each other really well, as if he's a frequent visitor to the mansion.
And they say visitor, gatecrasher, same difference.
And we learn that they may in fact be the world's two greatest detectives. And we're not going to say which order one and two are. They're pretty evenly matched, actually.
So, of course, we get both of them together at the very end. Alfred brings out the presents, and they both sit next to each other, inspecting the wrapped gifts.
Detecting them.
And figuring out what exactly it is that they have each received for Christmas.
This one, for me, was probably the highlight. It's one of those cases of flipping through the table of contents. This was the most anticipated story for me, and it met that. There were a couple that took me by surprise, where low expectations may have helped. But when a story, a book, a TV, a movie with high expectations can still please me, I take note of that.
And this story, like pretty much all of them, has a really good, lighthearted feel, mm-hmm. has a admittedly cheesy, but perfectly cheesy Christmas
resolution,
Christmas
premise.
Special twist ending.
Michael Bailey will have already seen a story like this 3 or 4 times on the Hallmark Channel.
Yes. So we would say a perfect, strangely enough, a perfect send up to cheesy Christmas
movie,
made for TV movie, and weirdly enough, Frank Miller ish Dark Knight. Sensibilities, and the fact that it can pull off both at the same time is incredible.
And it has that nice message at the end. I know it sounds cracked, but I think we actually saved Christmas that year, Batman and me. And I got what I wanted for the holiday season, to be surrounded by good friends and good cheer. Here's hoping you get the same. Happy holidays, Bobo.
Back in the frame story, we get to learn some things about Amazonian solstice traditions, which starts off a little odd, but very, very interesting. Of one of the Amazons is chosen by lot to give gifts to the others in the masked guise of Diana. Oh, that's very nice, Harley says, and then Diana cuts in. Of course, the bold Amazons attempt to unmask her, and if she is unmasked, she must do combat, and the losing challenger must dress up as a doe and be sent on a simulated hunt, where if captured, they will be symbolically skinned and prepared for baking in a giant pastry shell, but will be spared if they can amuse the hunters, such as dancing like chickens. It's all in good fun, of course, and you can just see Harley and Superman in the background getting more and more disconcerted.
But again, you've seen this on live TV, where the story that the host is trying to pull out of the guest is not exactly what they anticipated, and the looks that on that cross Harley's face are you're saying what? Huh?
And she finally answers it. Wow, that was weird. What about you, Supes? And Clark just looks baffled. Both of them goes, my folks just put up a tree. But this leads us into our solstice story.
And this may have been your most anticipated story.
And my favorite.
See? Wonder Woman and Constantine dreaming of a white Christmas.
I was sold on this premise from the start, had high expectations, and those expectations were met. We open on December 21st in Lancaster, England, and John has crashed a witch's solstice looking for a particular witch who has recently cursed him with horrible nightmares. Everybody else knows that this has happened, that he's been hexed, and they're all making fun of him, and he's grumbling, only to run into a proper classy lady, Wonder Woman. Who has crashed the same party looking for Dionysus, who is apparently pimped off from Olympus, where he's supposed to be, and is drinking with the mortals.
You can't trust the god to stay put.
You really can't. So the two of them team up to look for their respective witches.
And it goes about as well as you would think.
Yes, there are ghostly summonings, there are chases, in John's own words. Who doesn't enjoy a brisk sprint through the English winter countryside? Me.
It is hard to run and smoke at the same time, I would imagine. Somehow he manages to do it.
Skills. Skills. So finally, Wonder Woman lassoes this guy who we think is probably maybe Dionysus. Mm-hmm. Probably. They find the witch, and her terms are that she will unhex John if he tells her what exactly the deepest, darkest manifested fear that he was cursed with was. He, absolutely not, I'm not going to. Wonder Woman kind of bends his arm into confessing, tells the witch, and she just busts up laughing. So that's a good one. Night, John. Have sweet dreams.
It's a good thing she didn't have to break out the lasso of truth. That could have really gotten ugly.
That could have gotten embarrassing, because he finally goes back to the inn where he's staying, goes upstairs, crashes in his chair, falls asleep, and is dreaming that he is forced to sit on Santa's lap in the mall.
Nightmare of all nightmares.
You know, there are few characters that just really pull off a true Grinch quite as well as my boy JC, and that was hilarious.
Back in the variety show, we get the Harley and the Ivy. They have to hang out at some point in every special, but you cannot have the holiday special without the Harley and the Ivy joke.
And it turns out that because Ivy can't quite be trusted, she may have spiked the eggnog, as all of the rogues and Flash and Superman are all just gathered around the piano, drunkenly singing Christmas carols at the top of their lungs.
Evidence seems to point in that direction. Yes. And speaking of rogues, we get the Flash in a Flash Christmas carol. And this is why we love James Tynion.
God, it's so good.
There have probably been stories like this before that talk about the unique relationship that Flash has to his rogues, but I really like this take on it.
The story starts with Barry visiting a kid who he knows who's in foster care. Mm-hmm. And the kid is kind of concerned, like, is Santa going to be able to find my house? Santa's used to me living with my mom. Mm-hmm. And now I'm in this new city. Is he going to know I'm in Central City? How's he going to find me? And the Flash says, well, in this city, Santa has some special helpers.
Mm-hmm.
And tells the story of one Christmas Eve when the rogues were trying to knock over a bank, and the Flash went and stopped them. Of course, Captain Cold has planted bombs all over the city, and he has to go disarm the bombs or stop the rogues. He manages to do both, but in their final confrontation,
yes,
they end up overturning a delivery truck full of presents for the local foster kids.
And Captain Cold steps up, says, Flash, can you get these where they need to go in time? Because having a bad holiday, it can mess up a kid for a pretty long time.
So Cold calls off the rogues, physically has to drag away the trickster because he does not understand the true meaning of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And Flash and Cold share a moment where he's like, Leonard, thank you.
Have a merry one, Flash. Trust I'll be making your life hell in a few weeks.
Flash says, I look forward to it. So Flash, this jolly man in a red suit with super speed, gathers up all the presents and runs around the city at super speed, putting them all under the trees of all of the good little boys and girls of Central City. And Malcolm is tucked into bed. It's like, oh, thanks for telling me that, Mr. Barry. I feel much better now. And Iris wishes him a good night and a Merry Christmas.
Whoosh!
He wakes up in the middle of the night and goes downstairs, and who's waiting for him but the Flash.
And that's why the rogues take a couple weeks off at
every
the end
Christmas.
Of the year. Yes. Obviously, the Flash and the rogues are known for their, as we said, unique symbiotic relationship. I love this sort of version of how that starts. And it does pull a little bit on sort of the Captain Cold from the TV show.
Yes, this definitely
pulls in
some of that.
Sort of referencing some of the more modern takes.
And Barry's connection to foster care and mm-hmm. having that very strong feeling. Also his relationship with Captain Cold, of them both knowing each other's secret identities and sort of collabing. It's really, really mm-hmm. heartwarming.
Then we get the new Superman in Day of Returning.
Now, I don't know much about New Superman. I haven't Mm-mm. read hardly any about New Superman, but it's just a little one-page cute story about Christmas in China, and mm-hmm. the Chinese Wonder Woman says, oh, it's not actually Christmas. It's the winter solstice, Dongji. So it's all about going to the cemetery and visiting with your family, sort of a Day of the Dead,
mm-hmm.
communing and remembering type of day, and the Chinese poison ivy equivalent shows up, and they end up taking her home and having tangguan, which is rice balls, and having quote-unquote Christmas together, mm-hmm. which is cute.
Though I hope you realize you'll be returning to jail after this. Shh, let her enjoy her food. Then we get one of the stranger interludes, Harley tapping into her ethnic heritages of her mom being Catholic and her father being Jewish. So she walks in with a thing on her head that looks like it could be from a reindeer, but it has lit candles on it.
Menorantlers. Merry Christmaka, one and all.
And one of the things I like about this one is we failed to mention the highlight of the book, which is all throughout this scene of the frame sequence, we have Black Canary and Zatanna singing the 12 Days of Christmas.
The whole 12 Days of Christmas. So every time you go back, they're about three iterations further.
Further, yes. But here we have their floating heads trying to quite figure out exactly what Harley's doing, and they look 1940s pinup girl. Not quite bombshells.
But it's close.
But pretty close. And adorable.
And I will say that the highlight of this, well, really, there is no highlight. This page itself is a highlight of the frame sequence because We get Black Canary is very much in a sort of bombshells,
heels,
and gloves, sort of opera singer sort of vibe. And Zatanna is wearing a red cummerbund and green fishnets.
Getting into the spirit in her own way.
Which is great. And
It's beyond great. It's adorbs. It's adorbs.
And, of course, as they are singing the 12 Days of Christmas, Zatanna is, of course, singing it backwards.
So all these things are appearing.
Summoning all these things out of her hat. And they have just gotten to 8 maids a-milking. And you have some Austrian dairy maids getting pulled out of Zatanna's hat who are very confused as to where they have ended up and what is happening. And the dairy maids proceed to stick around for the rest of the frame sequence.
Yes.
And the climax of this page is Zatanna says, you know, those really seem to be rather inappropriate. And Harley's like, what says you? I think that they give equal recognition and celebration to both traditions. I mean, inappropriate to have on stage. You're setting the pear tree on fire. And Harley falls, drops her menorah lures, gets doused in water, and sort of picks them up. Maybe I better take up a more orthodox approach. Let me just tell you, the puns in this book are great. We missed it earlier, but in the Superman Batman story, there is a part where the caption says, "And as the night wanes."
Yeah.
And I was
it does. Oh. Yeah, it does.
Oh.
Now we have a more...
I'm gonna assume that was on purpose, because it has to be.
And here, orthodox is bold by the letterer, so they knew the joke at least. Or, Batwoman in Light in the Dark.
We got a Hanukkah special!
I'm pretty sure that the placement of this story was to make up for menorah antlers.
Yes.
Let's put the respectful one here.
There is actually a really good job of the organization of these stories, that the frame story does a good job of leading into each one. So you have the Crypto Christmas special and the Crypto story. You have the menorah antlers, and then you have the Hanukkah story. So they actually do a really good job. Also, a thing that I didn't quite pick up until we finished it was that it goes in roughly chronological order. You have the Christmas Eve stories, and then the Christmas stories. Then you have the Solstice stories, which technically should have happened earlier. Hanukkah.
And Hanukkah can fit this year. It starts this Christmas year, Eve, Christmas so it Eve. Goes after. The days of Hanukkah are after Christmas.
And then you get the post-Christmas stories at the very end, which we are excited about.
This was a tradition Kate had with her father of going to the corner deli and having pie with her father. For Hanukkah.
And then he would tell the Hanukkah story. Mm-hmm. And even though she can't do that anymore, she still does that to sort of bring herself some little nostalgic joy. And of course,
things happen.
Shady, criminal, Matrix looking men in black suits show up. Kate has to go take them down and stop this international.
Some sort of, EMP pulse has gone off and
killed all of the electricity in the city.
And it took a little while for Oracle, with her little cat glasses and bat ears, her a little while to get her systems going. But once they did, she was able to set Kate back on the right path.
Go beat up the bad guys, stop the arms dealers.
With maybe the quote of the issue.
While kicking them in the face.
Kicking them in the face. Happy holidays, jerks.
Sets a bomb, blows up the building, grabs her contact, rappels out the window, and he says, "Oh, thanks for saving my life. I owe you." And she says, "Maybe you can repay me with pie." So she and Oracle and her contact all go back to the corner diner. Of course, a menorah is brought along. Yes. Kate's like, "I really can't believe that you just had a menorah lying around." "Yeah, so I picked it up on the way over. Shoot me."
And you know what? The holiday isn't a bust. We're having pie, aren't we? With family.
And of course, right at that moment, the lights come on. It's a Hanukkah miracle. That's just the power coming on, but sure, I'll let you have this one. And their context is, so what else happens in this tradition? And Kate says, well, Dad would retell the story of the Maccabees. Badly. Like he was pitching a movie.
Okay. So are you going to do it?
All right. Cut to 2,000 years ago.
And then we have Harley is going to try to read us a nice classy Christmas story.
We're going to have our highbrow Dickensian moment this Christmas, but...
Raven ends up getting bonked in the head, and Beast Boy doesn't really offer much help either.
They tried.
Which leads us into the Titans story. Now, before you mentioned it, I hadn't noticed how good the organization was, but it does sort of make sense. Your interstitials should be introducing the next good eyes there.
So we have the frame sequence with the new Teen Titans. Mm-hmm. Then we have a New Year's story with the Titans.
And it's got your favorite character, Arsenal with the backwards hat.
It's a stupid hat. I love Roy so much, but his fashion choices are terrible.
But I like this version of Donna. I like this version of Dick Grayson.
Yes, where you got the black jumpsuits for both of them. It's nice. And, of course, there are some people causing mayhem on New Year's Eve.
This happens.
The drag racing and robots and just general craziness. Throughout the whole thing, Roy keeps being like, man, I'm going to be late. You know, we're in New York to see the ball drop and we're going to be late to go see it. And Dick Grayson gives him a little crack like, really? You know, this is the whole reason you brought us here just because you wanted to play tourist and get a New Year's kiss. And he goes, no, it's not that. And he...
Well, a little bit.
But it goes into a kind of heartfelt moment where he's like, you know, I don't talk about my addiction all that much. But that was a thing in Narcotics Anonymous that was really important to have these moments
milestones
and starting a new year and making resolutions that you're going to have a better year and that you're going to follow those resolutions. And
I really wanted to celebrate a good fresh start together.
Yeah. And it has a little tie-in to some of the craziness that's been going on in their book with all the timeline stuff. And he's like, this year has been nuts.
Yes.
And I just wanted a clean, fresh, normal start. And everyone's sort of like, oh, man, oh, that's sweet. And they all get a moment together. Now, of course, they set up a trap to stop the illegal drag racers. And they catch them just as the ball drops and the fireworks go off. And then we get Roy's closing narration of, just goes to show you, a fresh start's only as good as the people that you make it with. And, you know, Nightwing sort of apologizes. I'm sorry you missed your big moment. And he's like, no, this is good. My time here with you guys, this is good. That's
The end. Everybody's happy, except that Dick Grayson just realizes, whoa, I'm late. Which leads us into the one-page story of Batgirl and Nightwing. And I don't want to be late. And you see the evening, the same evening, compressed from Batgirl's perspective, three or four panels of her running around the city, saving people, beating up bad guys, helping the police, keeping things from getting too crazy. And she's thinking, I think I can still make it. I think I can still make it to the bridge. And then we have a nice scene of Dick Grayson, Nightwing, climbing up one side of the bridge, and Batgirl climbing up the other side of the bridge, and they both say, Sorry, wait, are you? Why don't we just stay here and watch what's left of the fireworks? That sounds perfect. And Ms. Stella Bowman celebrates with joy.
Champagne corks popping everywhere.
Because Dick Grayson is with his girlfriend, and it sure ain't Starfire.
And this at last brings us to the final independent story, which is Epiphany.
Because we had Christmas, and we've had
Solstice,
and Hanukkah, and even New Year's. So what's left? Well, January 6th, the 12th night, is left. And in the Green Lanterns, plural, book, we have Jessica Cruz and Simon Baz. The premise is that they are rookie Green Lanterns, just getting to know each other. So a little culture clash, a little bit of an odd couple friendship, you know, buddy cop sort of idea.
And in that book, there was one issue around Halloween where Jessica went over and spent the day with Simon's family, and they're Muslim. So they were observing some kind of tradition and making cookies and having a holiday. And she got to hang out with them, and it was awkward, but it was nice, and it was good, and it was getting together with friends and family.
So this is returning the favor, having him over for
cookies and tamales.
Yes, that's right. Three Kings Day. And in Mexico, the tradition, friends and family gather, and they eat the bread that's shaped like a wreath, king's bread or king's cake it's sometimes called in English. And it has a little figurine of the baby Jesus baked inside. Whoever gets the piece that has the toy in it has the baby Jesus inside. That is good luck for them. And it actually does add some additional party-giving responsibilities to them down the road.
It's similar to if anyone celebrates Fat Tuesday.
Similar concept.
Have a cake. There's a...
Something
there's
inside.
A present
yes.
Inside
exactly.
the cake. And so... Jessica and her sister are cooking. Simon is hanging around being vaguely useless when they get summoned by a duty. And they're like, "Welp, we'd rather stick around for tamales, but hopefully we'll be back in time for dinner." And so they take off.
And it's a standard alien testing of the heroes sort of story.
However, the aliens which have arrived to do the testing are all... riding vaguely camel-ish alien pack beasts and wearing long robes and crowns.
Did we mention there are three of them?
Yes, there are. And thus, Simon and Jessica, they have to go through the three trials of suffering, sincerity, and integrity to prove that the Earth is worthy of existing. And, of course, they kind of try to fight them, but you can't because Star Trek logic. So the first test is they are each returned to the place where the ring found them, which in Simon's case was prison.
Guantanamo Bay, to be precise.
Yes. And in Jessica's case was locked inside her apartment with extreme agoraphobia.
For going on 3 years.
And we get to see panels compared between the two.
Very nicely organized page.
Both of them sort of wrestling with their problems and actually in Simon's case saying, "I did this once and I could do it again, but you better not have put Jessica back there." And it's really nice to see because in the book it is very much an odd couple kind of buddy cop thing where he's needling her all the time for being the rookie. He's had his ring a whole 4 months longer than her.
Right.
So he knows.
Exactly.
He knows what's going on.
There's a tiny bit of mansplaining that goes on as part of their relationship.
And so it's nice to see him sticking up for Jess. And
yes.
So they both are shown by accepting this ring, you will be in danger and your family will be endangered and you'll be in pain. You'll have all these responsibilities. And they both independently say yes. So congratulations, they have passed the first test. The second test is the trial of sincerity. And the three wise aliens say, "You must choose who is worthy to stand in service to the sector. Who is the true Green Lantern of Sector 2814? And Jessica immediately goes, "Well, I know what Simon's going to say. Sorry, rookie. We both know that I've got a better chance. I've got to be the one to take up this, and you need to stand down." And Simon says, "You think you can pit us against each other? That's not how it works. We have two lanterns.
We're both Green Lanterns here.
It's both of us or neither." And they say, "Congratulations.
You have passed the second
test. You have passed the test, Simon Baz."
Now, the third test is a fight to the death with a construct purple evil-looking alien.
And Simon immediately gets his butt kicked.
Yeah.
Which, I love Simon. I also love seeing Simon get his butt kicked, because he deserves it about 45% of the time.
And one of the ongoing themes is Jess's slow ability to do Green Lantern-y construct things.
Yes.
That has been a struggle for her.
Working through and working with her anxiety. And so the chips are down. Her quote-unquote superior senior officer is down, and it's just her. And so the aliens say, you have a choice. You can either withdraw from combat and you will live, or fight to the death. And she says, well, I guess I'm doing this, and tries to summon a sword and shield, and it's kind of fuzzy and not quite put together, but gosh darn it, she's trying.
Well done, Jessica Cruz. The final test of integrity has been successfully completed. What? What? What just happened?
What just happened here? And so they say, Earth stands judged. You have overcome your trials. You are victorious, and we will return again in time. And until then, we offer your people a gift they may have tomorrow. And they immediately beam off, and Simon and Jessica are like, what is going on? They try to call Hal, and he's like, I have no idea what you two rookies are talking about. There hasn't been any alien activity in that sector. Are you guys high? And, oh, no, it's...
never mind,
it's
we're
cool,
fine.
Never mind, we're...
just checking on you.
Bye, Hal. Click.
Back to her place, where they are having their cake, and Simon crunches into something. Your baking isn't all that good. Did you put rocks in this thing?
It's not a rock. You found the prize.
What's the prize? A toothache?
No, Simon. It's hope. I love
this
story. That
was a great story. First off, as we said, Hanukkah does not get enough love in terms of holiday stories.
Neither does Epiphany.
Neither does Twelfth Night Epiphany, Three Kings Day, whatever you want to call it. Because remember,
Christmas lasts until January.
Keep that in mind. 12 days. 12 days. And I like the story that recognizes that.
Yes.
And it ends with hope.
And of course, we have our final page, the wrap-up, where at last, and a partridge in a pear tree.
Of course, Zatanna then has to gather up all of the things that she has pulled from other dimensions, and she's found them all, like, except for those 5 gold rings.
Oh, yeah, Harley's like, wow.
Anyway, we need to move
crazy,
on. It's time to go.
Thing.
Okay, bye. Holding her hand behind her back. Anyway, no thievery going on here.
So that's our show. And before we fly back up our chimneys, me and the gang want to share a few sentiments. And everybody wishes everyone a happy holidays. Very happy, merry end of the year. Harley's like, yeah, and if you thought this special was special, just wait until next year. It's gonna be bigger. It's gonna be better. No expense spared. We're gonna break the bank. We are not going to waste all of our budget next year so that this is all we can do. And 3 months later,
it's happy St. Patty's Day, and they've drunk their entire year's worth of party budgets. And Amanda Waller says, oh, yes, yes.
And to all, a good night.
That was 96, 88, whatever it was, pages.
Of awesome.
Of pretty fun reads.
It did what I think a holiday special should always do. Respect all of the different traditions.
Poke an appropriate amount of fun at some of, at them
at,
in,
at
in
everyone.
An appropriate, yes.
At everyone.
Exactly.
It was really good. It was really, really good.
Agreed. So we heartily recommend that you run out to Hoopla at the middle of January and get this for free. Or hopefully, if someone loved you, they gave it to you for Christmas. But even if you didn't get it for Christmas, it's people still love you. I mean, I'm not saying that.
Merry Christmas, everybody. And we'll be right back after this seasonally inappropriate musical interlude.
It is that time of year again. Kill a tree for Jesus. He died to save us from our sins. Now we kill a tree for Jesus. Once back in
And we're back.
And we want to thank our friends, Insomniac Folklore, for providing the additional music in this episode. And even though Insomniac Folklore is in Nashville currently for industry music business reasons, if you couldn't tell, they're from Portland.
Like Portland.
Really from Portland. That explains the weird. Well, we have awesome listeners who regularly send us awesome feedback. So it's time to go through the entire big old bag of your emails, faxes, and notes. Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks and Punch Like a Girl has been listening to a bunch of our old episodes, both here and at Relatively Geeky, our main podcast feed. He wrote in here to ask what our thoughts are on the Constantine film starring Keanu Reeves.
Tilda Swinton deserves a better film to be Gabriel in. I have never actually seen that movie. The only thing I care about from that movie is that Gabriel was played by Tilda Swinton in perhaps the most inspired casting for an angel since Alan Rickman.
Now, I have not seen the Constantine film either. And I know that it's somewhat negatively viewed in terms of sort of general geek consensus. We were big fans of the TV show, Constantine.
Well, the TV show is much better than the movie.
We recognize its shortcomings, though. It was imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of the TV show, it's one of those things. Had it come along a couple years later, had it been developed by Greg Berlanti, had it been on the CW instead of NBC,
like,
maybe things could have been different.
That was just like, if there was one network that you could put this show on for it to fail.
Friday night at 10 o'clock on NBC might have been the... We did love his appearance on Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And again, portrayed by Matt Ryan.
Justice League Dark is coming out soon.
Again, with...
Matt Ryan. I did see that he has made an appearance in Justice League Action.
Oh, yes.
The new animated. Sort of, yeah, the more kid-friendly mm-hmm. of the animated series. Not played by Matt Ryan, mm-hmm. and under the power of a accent-exaggerating curse.
I heard that.
Which is... Yeah. Amazing.
Yes. My views on the Constantine film are that I know Keanu Reeves. I've seen Keanu Reeves in movies. Keanu Reeves is a movie star. Keanu Reeves is no Matt Ryan.
Pretty much. On our last episode about Over the Garden Wall, Bradley Null wrote in, "This time, I listened while walking, not driving."
Yes, good. Our safety message is getting through.
So I have a few more comments. None of them on Over the Garden Wall, as I haven't watched it yet.
What?
However, I do plan on watching it today, which is Halloween/Savna. I was taught to pronounce it like a pig's victory, Samhain. But it's anglicized Celtic, so probably any pronunciation is equally right.
I actually kind of like that attitude. Yeah. If you're talking it being translated over centuries in multiple languages, I think putting your foot down and saying, "This is the correct way," is probably a fool's errand.
Most important thing that you need to recognize from this is what, however you pronounce it, Samhain is wrong.
Although Bradley did include in that a little story of in his D&D days, that he did have a wizard named Sam Hine, and nobody got the joke.
Aw, now that's unfortunate. Bradley continues, "For me, this day has three themed but separate holidays. The Thin Veil Trio of U.S. Halloween, Mexican Day of the Dead, and Neo-Pagan Samhain. I love dressing up, I love hanging out in cemeteries, and I have long celebrated the Wiccan High Holy Days even when less of a pagan. These represent three different ways of dealing with the idea of the dead returning, is a type of thinning of the veils. Maybe someday these veils will become thin enough for peace between these respective viewpoints. We live in hope."
Good point.
"I found your statements that everyone is that parent in terms of corruption to be interesting. I think I've spent so much time as that kid, the one who sees your church as the problem instead of people in it, that my knee-jerk reaction was, I never did that. However, I have been reminded by my dad that when I was first told Dungeons & Dragons was evil, I almost burned my books. I consider any flamed page threat to be wrong at this point. Good. However, my father tells me I became that way because I almost did that. So even I went through that phase. So I guess I have an apparently well-themed cartoon to watch. Thanks for the podcast and the recommended watching, Bradley Man. P.S. My other two must-watch Halloween stories are Nightmare Before Christmas and The Great Pumpkin Peanut Special. My holy stories are apparently wholly animated.
Bradley did, in fact, watch Over the Garden Wall a few days later, and his live Facebook updates included, "There's pumpkin-headed folk, my favorite!" Oh, wow, if you're a fan of old 30s and 40s animation, this is a special treat. And lastly, that was wonderful. As in, full of wonder. So we made a fan.
And I think that those three statements perfectly summarize Over the Garden Wall. I really wish we could have talked more about the 30s and 40s animation thing, but this, my friends, is an audio show.
David Ace Gutierrez made an observation about a certain trend he has noticed over the course of this podcast. "I feel that this show is slowly approaching a time when Emily just says, 'Dad, why don't you put that mic on mute? I got this.'"
Well, I mean,
maybe. That episode, the Over the Garden Wall episode, that was totally yours. And I can't remember when we decided to do the DC Rebirth holiday special. Whose idea was that?
I think that might have been mine.
Okay, David, I see your point, but I contribute pithy interjections every now and then, okay?
You can be the Andy Leyland of this show. No, you're not. I'm the Andy Leyland of the show. I just show up and make jokes. You do all the work. Patrick Delmore wrote in, "Just finished the episode. Very good. Going to try and get my dad to watch Over the Garden Wall with me. Work for us."
Our good buddy Neil Stanifer sent us something that I guess falls somewhere between dissertation and manifesto.
Which we appreciate.
He thanked us for a delightful and thought-provoking episode. I've added Over the Garden Wall to my viewing list for winter break, and I'm looking forward to it. And thanks for keeping the spoilers to the bare minimum necessary for discussion. Always appreciated. Emily's comments about syncretism caught my attention, especially as it relates to demons, angels, and other powers and principalities. I agree with both your views that many people in the U.S., even those only nominally religious or even professing no religious beliefs, leaped onto the angel bandwagon in the 90s. I personally found this a bit irritating, not only because of my own beliefs, but because I thought it cheapened a serious subject in theology, at least in the Abrahamic traditions. And here in his next sentence, we are totally on board with him, with what he says next.
Yes.
Angels, whether we believe in them or not, are a compelling, even terrifying concept. And I'll confess I was rankled when I saw them being reduced to kitsch.
Yes. We have a tag on the Tumblr, which is specifically for angels. And if you ever want to log into our page at like 2:30 in the morning and wet yourself, that is the place to go, because I have made it a personal goal.
Mission statement of the Tumblr.
Find all of the most terrifying, eldritch, mind-screamingly bizarre, and awesome, as in awe-inspiring,
yes,
angels that I can find on the internet.
Neil says, "Then again, this is the United States, so I suppose I had no right to expect deep theological and metaphysical topics to be treated with dignity and respect." Heavy existential sigh. But it isn't just religious believers who engage in syncretism. Among the nominally religious, or spiritual but not religious, as some pollsters frame it, I hear a lot of talk about spirits and energy. I think I could probably take the pronouncements of many New Age gurus, replace their references to positive and negative energy with angels and demons, and I would not have substantively altered what they've said. I think that speaks to people's lingering attachments to beliefs in the supernatural, or at least in the numinous. I don't share these beliefs, so I'm not sure what to make of them. Perhaps it has something to do with a hunger for the transcendent. Or maybe some non-theistic psychologists are correct when they say that humans have overactive agency detectors, such that we seek a volition, an agenda, even in random events. Perhaps that would explain why I get angry at my coffee table when I bang my shin into it, or when I get angry with the weather for raining during my long walk from the bus stop. Ah, the human condition. We are endlessly absurd.
Yes. Full darkness to light endorsement of these statements.
I have to say that I found an absence of internal consistency in the metaphysics in some of my Christian and spiritual friends. It's almost as though they've grabbed onto whatever bits and bobs of religious trappings seem the coolest, giving in to a kind of gee whiz impulse without stopping to consider the implications for the overall framework of their beliefs. I think this is interesting because from the sort of Christian academic perspective, this is what we call systematic theology, attempting to create a cohesive, consistent view. And yes, it is important. And I think among evangelicals who don't have a teaching magisterium, who don't have a catechism, who don't have some of those things, it is kind of rare.
Yeah. I think this is something that I know this is something that we are going to talk about in a later episode.
Yeah.
But this is what I like to refer to as religious fandom,
mm-hmm.
which is, for good and ill, this feeling of picking and choosing and creating your own spiritual concepts and putting together your own personal theology, as you said, somewhat without system, mostly based on, I think that's cool. And though a perfectly fine, I don't know, distraction thing to engage in when you're kind of bored, it's maybe not the greatest basis for mm-hmm. a systematic,
yes.
theological, metaphysical morality system.
Mm-hmm. Back to Neil. Take, for example, a handful of Christians I know who express a belief that the dead will rise again on a day of final judgment, but who also believe in ghosts. Or take my pagan friend, who subscribes to Wicca, but refused to read a scholarly book about the historical and scriptural origins of the biblical Satan because she doesn't want to mess with that stuff, fearing the devil as strongly as any Christian might.
Okay, this actually reminds me of a rather funny thing that I saw from Tumblr. It didn't quite make the cut for going on our blog, but there was a person who I followed who said, you know, one day I really want to write a demonic horror film in which members of the Church of Satan feature heavily, and when the ghosts and demons and monsters show up, they immediately start screaming and wet themselves in terror and throw up their hands and say, this is not on us, guys. This was not us.
In other words, he continues, I see this syncretism, at least in these kinds of cases, as a symptom of a loosely held and unexamined metaphysics. I guess that's why I'm always a bit surprised and delighted when I encounter a Christian who is conversant in scripture and commentary, or an atheist who actually knows how evolution and the First Amendment work, for that matter. I would also like to address your discussion of the liminal. I found this fascinating and began to think of Nathaniel Hawthorne's story, Young Goodman Brown. In this work, the protagonist comes to realize during a walk with a diabolical figure that his neighbors are not all who they seem to be. They're sinister, venal, and satanic, hiding their true evil behind a veil of pietism. I was also reminded of something I experienced as a small child, when a cherished plush animal in my bedroom turned up in a slightly different place than it was supposed to be, and no one could tell me how it had gotten there. I began immediately to view this small plush rabbit with intense suspicion, finally consigning it to a closet, first in my bedroom, and then later in the hall outside. It had become an object of horror and distraction to me. Yeah, I was a weird kid. But that rabbit was plotting something.
I'm going to ask. I don't really know his age, but at what age did you watch Poltergeist, my friend? Because I think that could answer a lot of that.
Of course, as soon as I connected Emily's liminal to young Goodman Brown, it made me think of all the ways this effect, or this aspect of this effect, turns up in pop culture. Think of the 70s film Race with the Devil, wherein two couples accidentally witness a satanic ritual and are then pursued across the Bible Belt by satanic cultists who've entirely taken over rural towns in the heart of America. Or think of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, or Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. That's another fine example. And of course, there's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. This idea that even our most familiar, most comforting encounters conceal something more sinister, something just beneath the veil. Yeah, I like stories like that. But of course, the liminal goes beyond this. And I thought of those things closer to the religious sublime, and that brought me to a book I was fortunate enough to have read in grad school, The Shoeings of Julian of Norwich.
Oh.
In case you're unfamiliar, this book contains the writing of a Christian anchoress. And among the tasty mystical morsels to be found in its pages, it includes the musings of this devout woman on one of the deepest mysteries of all of Christianity, the indwelling of the Trinity. There's a sense in Julian's writing that she is chasing something just beyond her intellectual reach, a secret or a mystery just beyond her fingertips. There's a secret world and it surrounds us, and we can sense it, scratch for it, but we just can't seem to reach it. I found Julian's thought process fascinating, like watching someone try to solve a locked room mystery based on computing pi to the final digit. I strongly recommend this book.
Likewise.
Anyway, enough out of me. Thanks for another great episode. Be well, and I hope you enjoyed your harvest season. Cheers, Neil Stanifer. Now, I have found a lot of value in thinking of Christianity as an Eastern mystery religion, remembering its roots, that it had a history long before the Reformation, well, long before Italy, long before the Reformation, long before Western Europe. And there are some folks inside and outside the church who are sort of uncomfortable with the concepts of mystery as part of the Christian faith. But I've come very comfortable with that over the years, especially in reading some of the great Catholic mystics of history. John of the Cross, Teresa, and of course, Julian of Norwich. We second that recommendation.
Yes. All of these comments are thoroughly darkness to light approved. We heard from the dastardly creative Luke Dobb, who said he was enjoying hearing us talk about Over the Garden Wall. I've been meaning to dive into darkness to light for a long time. Finally did today. This is a great concept for a podcast. Thank you. We thought so. And Ryan Daly commented that he was fascinated by this episode, and I hope that he is also one of the people who went out and watched the show.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Stella Bowman from the Batgirl to Oracle podcast said that she loves this show / movie. She tagged her buddy Donovan Morgan Grant, who said he was planning to rewatch it before listening to our episode.
Excellent.
Again, full approval.
And from Gene, the podcasting machine, Hendrix, who added his 2 cents, Emily and Alan, very interesting episode on the history of Halloween. I agree with Emily that modern paganism tends to overinflate their history, mainly because they want an unbroken way back to the old ways, like Christians have. Since it isn't a recreation of an actual religion, as Asatru is, for example, but something created in modern times, practitioners seem to need that veneer of history. It is amazing how much Catholic documentation is useful in recreating ancient religious practices, though. There was a lot of specific, if you do X on Y day at Z crossroads, it is a sin.
Which tells you what people were doing. As he said, yes.
That, along with other evidence from archaeology, history, etc., and we can say with relative certainty that this is a practice that our ancestors took part in. Quite fascinating. Something that puzzled me in your discussion is that the Christian church has no place for those in between, even though that was part of the point of the resurrection. Considering that the Bible considers the body and soul to be one, Jesus being bodily taken up to heaven, Matthew 10:28, saying that God can destroy both body and soul in hell, etc., aren't all Christians dead in a perpetual state of in-between until Judgment Day? Maybe I misunderstood what you were saying, but this seems like a contradiction to me. I think this goes back to Neil's comment earlier about sort of a difference between, we would say, doctrine and practice.
Yes, that's, yeah.
Because though that is doctrinal, the way that it's interpreted in practical people's understanding of that is very different. Because as Neil pointed out, there are people who say the dead will rise up on Judgment Day and only on Judgment Day. However, ghosts are real. Mm-hmm. How is that possible if the body and soul are one until Judgment Day? Mm-hmm. We're probably going to talk about this at a later date because it is something that varies a lot from person to person, is how death works within the Christian framework. Because as we have taken many episodes to say, the Christian framework is actually not terribly uniform.
Yes, yes.
I think that as far as us talking about liminal spaces, we meant more in a liminal doctrinal space, not so much talking about theology having to do with the dead. Mm-hmm. Because for you and I, we find occasional difficulty with people because of our theological feelings. That you being, let's say, too Protestant for Catholic websites and too Catholic for most Protestants, because you fall in that in-between space where you're supposed, there is this feeling that you need to stay in your own lane. And I think that's more what we were talking about when we talked about liminal spaces for Christians is liminal spaces within the physical church.
You know, I do agree with Gene that this maybe should not be an issue, like you were saying, but it's a theology and a practice issue, and it is less of an issue in some areas, branches of the church family tree, if you will. I think it's always important to remember, in terms of things like ghosts and those sorts of manifestations, that Protestants trace their heritage, our heritage, back to Puritans. And I think American evangelicals, American Puritans of all stripes, don't recognize that enough. And we don't really understand how much of our theology and practice is informed by that puritanical heritage.
Mm-hmm. So even if that's not stated in the doctrines of your sect, it's implied. And if you personally are a person who disagrees with that, you... me, quite possibly Neil, things can get uncomfortable. Gene ends his email by saying, also, I would like to ask you a personal favor. Please stop adding things to my I want to watch this list. I do not have the time. Sincerely, Gene.
Fortunately, the DC Rebirth Holiday Special is something to read, not watch in a strict technical sense.
And unlike Over the Garden Wall, it will not take you 125 minutes.
But that's a good 35, 40.
30 minutes, probably.
So let me say to all the feedbackers, thanks for the feedback. And to all the listeners, thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. And we will steal a scene from the last page of the Rebirth Special to wish you holiday cheer.
Have a Merry Christmas.
And a great Kirgoff.
A cool Yule, yo.
Season's greetings.
Feliz Navidad.
Sip Nothre.
Blessed Solstice.
Happy Hanukkah.
Shangdan Kwai Li.
Joyous Kwanzaa.
Happy New Year.
And may the Force be with you.
And also with you.
While you're waiting for the next podcast episode, check out our websites. DorknessToLight.blogspot.com contains reviews, essays, and other similar ramblings.
And DorknessToLight.tumblr.com, which contains some of that material, as well as top tens, cool photographs, memes, and religious puns. We also run a general interest comic book podcast network, Relatively Geeky. That content can be found at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or by searching iTunes for Relatively Geeky.
Let us know what you think of this topic, this episode, or this podcast in general. Feel free to send your thoughts to us at dorknesstolight@gmail.com. We would also appreciate any ratings or reviews left for the podcast in the iTunes store to help like-minded people find us.
Our intro, outro, and promo music is by Anderson Kale. Check them out at andersonkale.com or search iTunes to purchase their music.
Thanks for listening.
On Christmas Day, we'll be singing all day long. On Christmas Day in the morning.